From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what was it like up there at the tip of the Mackinac Bridge helping to build it 60 years ago?
You can see for, well, infinity just about either way. You can see to the horizon. You can either look one way and be looking all the way up Lake Michigan, and look the other way and you're looking up Lake Huron.
Facebook and how it can hurt the way you see your life.
What you're doing if you're passively scrolling is you're continually seeing how good everyone else's life is.
And DIA Director Graham Beal tells us about the major new exhibit that takes us deep into the year that Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo spent in Detroit.
Frida, when she came here, I wouldn't say she was unformed as an artist, but she hadn't found her personal voice.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Forget President Andrew Jackson. Should Rosa Parks be on our $20 bill?
2015, we are a much more diverse and inclusive country, and we think that our money should reflect that.
I'm Cynthia Canty. On Stateside today, voting begins for a new female face for the $20 bill. We'll check in with the group behind this campaign. But first, it looks like some Michigan lawmakers who are not happy with the May ballot proposal to increase road funding are trying to come up with an alternative. Jonathan Osteen covers the Capitol for MLive.com. Hello, Jonathan.
Hi, Cindy.
So what is this Plan B that some legislators have in mind?
Well, Plan B, which is being introduced in the House, is actually going to sound very familiar to a lot of people because, as the sponsor Gary Gunn calls it, it's essentially the Bolger Plan, which the House actually approved last year. What that plan would have done and would do under this new legislation is eliminate the sales tax on fuel, but then increase fuel taxes by a similar amount. It aims to be a revenue-neutral plan, but that would dedicate all of the taxes paid at the pump to roads.
Well, let's just point out the obvious. The Bolger plan didn't get enough support last year. It cleared the House, but it didn't even get a vote in the Senate. So what makes Representative Glenn and other supporters think there's going to be a different story this year?
Well, the legislature is a bit more conservative, of course, than last year. Gary Glenn said that's the beautiful thing about term limits is that there's turnover and new people in power who will make those sorts of decisions. But really, the issue here is not only the Senate, but the governor. The governor criticized what's being called the Bolger Plan pretty significantly last year. He said it would really hurt schools and cities which rely on sales tax revenue for some of their funding. So by eliminating that sales tax on fuel, you would potentially cut the amount of future funding that schools and cities can get.
Well, and as you note in your story for MLive, even Jace Bolger himself, he says, I'm supporting Proposal 1. He wrote a letter, as you say, to Michigan voters saying he supports it. And we certainly can't imagine that any Democrats are going to buy into this, are we?
No, definitely not. I mean, that issue I talked about involving the school aid fund, that's going to be a big sticking point for Democrats. So if the legislature did want to even try and go around Rick Snyder, you know, perhaps try and get enough votes to beat a veto, they wouldn't be able to do so just because of the number of Democrats that are in the House. Now, Gary Glenn points out, and I want to make this clear, that his plan wouldn't cut school spending, but what it would do is limit future revenue growth for the school aid fund. So it's a similar debate to what we heard with education funding in the governor's race last year. Actual education funding may have increased, but potential education funding did not.
Well, we know the governor and proponents of that Proposal 1 have been saying, this is it. This is the plan. There's no Plan B. So how much of a headache do you think this new legislation might give them?
Well, I don't know how much of a headache it's going to be because I think anyone who takes a real critical look at it will note what you and I already discussed, which is that this didn't pass last year. So whether it's politically feasible or not is really the question. And this isn't the only idea being discussed, though. Over in the Senate, Senator Pat Kolbeck is exploring a bunch of different ideas. But again, a lot of those are going to be unusual and potentially controversial. For instance, he's just looking at all sorts of ways to save the state money. One of his ideas is to cut funding for Planned Parenthood. So whether or not that's a feasible idea or not remains to be seen. But certainly from a talking point perspective, it gives critics of Proposal 1 ammunition to say, no, in fact, we do have other ideas. Here's what they are.
So the governor's kind of facing some challenges in relentless positive action, isn't he?
Well, yeah, you could say that. I mean, this whole Rhodes ordeal has been sort of a trial in relentless positive action for the governor. He's, of course, been pushing for funding for 3 years now. Would have preferred that the legislature did come up with a standalone solution, but signed off on what we have now, which is Proposal 1.
Jonathan Osteen covering the Capitol for MLive.com. As always, Jonathan, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Who moved my cheese? That's the title of the career and life planning book by Spencer Davis. But the driver of a Michigan truck is asking the question, who stole my cheese? Someone stole a Michigan tractor trailer packed with $85,000 worth of shredded mozzarella. It was parked at a truck stop in Florida the other night. The truck was being serviced, and somehow thieves managed to make off with a refrigerated trailer. The missing mozzarella was bound for a Hungry Howie's Pizza Distribution Center in Central Florida. There is no word on whether police plan to follow their noses in search for the missing cheese. Do you know what is being done with the specimen you donate to medical science, the blood, plasma, tissue, or any other sample that you might hand over to a biobank? Does knowing the intended use help or hinder donations? That's what researchers from Michigan State University and the University of Michigan try to discover with a new study that's been published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Co-author Raymond DeVries is a bioethics professor at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
What did you and co-author Tom Tomlinson of Michigan State want to figure out?
Well, we were concerned that folks who were donating their blood or their tissue to biobanks weren't fully informed of the possible future uses of this tissue. And we thought these folks might be interested to know that their tissues could be used in a variety of ways instead of the current way of getting consent from people, which is just to say, thanks for your blood, thanks for your tissue. We're going to use this in future research to find cures and to promote the health of the population, but we can't tell you at this point exactly what that research may be.
So what kind of questions and situations did you suggest to these people?
Well, then we first asked everyone, would you be willing to donate tissue using blanket consent? And then we said, would you be willing to donate your tissue even if you discovered? And then we gave them a list of possible future research projects that might be involved. And it was everything from research that would develop patents for pharmaceutical companies to research that would create vaccines against biological weapons. So we were kind of looking, and I should underscore that these are hypotheticals. We don't really know what biobanks doing this kind of research, but we wanted to give people a range of things that may be done in the future with their donations.
As you got answers back from people, what did you see? What specific projects caused a drop in people being willing to donate?
Well, we did find certain things really reduce the percentage of folks who said, now I'm willing to give my blood or my tissue. One of the more striking ones, it was when people were asked, are you willing to have your blood and tissue be used to develop patents that will earn profits for commercial companies? The percentage of people willing to donate dropped from 68% to 55%. We also asked, would you be willing to donate to a bank if you knew that bank was going to develop more safe and effective methods of abortion? And that, too, diminished the willingness to donate from 68% down to about 50%.
What do these findings tell us, do you think?
Well, you know, our concern is that the people have moral concerns that really would influence their willingness to donate to biobanks. And we think if we're getting consent for these donations, it's only fair that people understand there are future possible uses, and those uses may counter things that they find morally proper. And so these findings tell us that when we're getting consent, we really need to consider ways of informing people about the possible future uses of the donations they're giving to a biobank. And at present, we absolutely don't do that. We don't give people an option to say, if you're going to do this kind of research, please don't use my tissues. Basically, people give it and say, go ahead and do whatever you like.
Are you now opening up that idea that people, before they donate, would have stipulations that they might want to consider putting stipulations into their donation?
Yeah, another part of our research actually was we asked people to think with us about ways of getting better informed consent. And we proposed a number of different policy options for them, suggesting everything from sticking with blanket consent to going to a very complicated way of getting consent, which would involve every time your tissue being used, you were contacted either by email or by phone saying, we'd like to use your research in this use your donation in this kind of research. And we ask people to respond to those different ways of getting consent. And I think this is one of our more interesting findings, that people generally, when looking at these different possibilities, thought blanket consent really wasn't the ideal way, but they also thought this complicated way of getting consent, which would cost a lot of money, was also not ideal, because they realized that would hinder research in the future. So we're exploring ways in the middle of just alerting people that there might be some moral concerns, to more specific, giving people categories. I would not like my research used in developing biological weapons. I would not like my tissues used in developing different methods of abortion or for patented drugs, et cetera, et cetera.
And certainly the findings in your study sends a message to medical researchers and biobanks, doesn't it?
Clearly, that the folks who are donating really need to be informed of the possibilities in the future of the way their donations may be used. I should add, we're planning to do some deliberative democracy sessions later this year to actually explore deeper the reasons people are giving for these responses, because survey techniques are good. They give you a snapshot of what people are thinking, but they don't give you insight into the logic, the reasoning, what is behind these people's attitudes. So in the coming year, we're going to be doing more in-depth look at what is driving these attitudes on the part of people. And we hope that'll give us more insight into how to develop better consent methods.
Raymond DeVries is co-director of the Center for Bioethics and Social Sciences in Medicine at the University of Michigan, along with his co-author, Tom Tomlinson of Michigan State University. The study is published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're so very welcome. My pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Detroit Institute of Arts is preparing to unveil a major exhibition focusing on two of the most influential artists of the 20th century, Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo in Detroit, open Sunday. It takes us deep, deep into the year that Rivera and Kahlo spent in Detroit. Graham Beal is director, president, and CEO of the DIA. And Graham, it seems to me that an exhibition of this magnitude takes a lot of time and work to pull together. So at the same time that you were pulling this exhibition together, you were fighting to keep the DIA alive. And it seems this really is a kind of celebration of this new chapter for the DIA.
Yes, the idea occurred to me about 10 years ago. And as I looked into it further, began to understand how significant Rivera was for the whole American art scene in the 1930s. And so the show expanded away from just the focus on here, and then we got into the questions of the millage and whether the DIA was going to be around, if the millage didn't pass, all that kind of thing. And so it was put on hold. But once the millage was through and we knew that we had life in front of us, I revived the idea, going back to the original notion of just focusing on the couple's time here in Detroit. But it meant that we had to go back and renegotiate all the loans that we'd negotiated 7-8 years earlier.
Such detail and behind-the-scenes work that the public has no idea what it takes to mount an exhibit of this type. I think many of us know the broad strokes of this story, that the couple came to Detroit in April 1932 in the depths of the Depression because Rivera had won the commission to create the Detroit Industry Murals, which, of course, are now a National Historic Landmark. But what is the deeper story that you want to tell through this exhibition?
Well, Rivera came here. He was actually asked if he would be interested in doing the mural by William Valentin, the then director, and Edsel Ford very quickly agreed to pay for it. And he came with his young wife, Frida. They'd been married for a couple of years. And when he came here, he was famous. He'd just been given the second one-artist exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, the first one being Matisse. That's how important he was considered to be. So he was feted, and he was such a personality. But Frida, when she came here, I wouldn't say she was unformed as an artist, but she hadn't found her personal voice. So you had these two people in very, very different stature. Ironically, now we look back on it knowing that for the last 25 years of the 20th century, it was Frida who outshone her husband in the minds of many. So that's the crux of the story, and the fact that Frida didn't like it here at all. She didn't much like the U.S. at all. She came and went to New York because at least she said she could get good food there. And she was known to be sort of quite a prankster in a way. and she spoke fairly good English, but would pretend to misunderstand English and would drop swear words in polite company as if she didn't really know English. And she really, although she had toyed with it before, she really adopted a Mexican dress. What we think of Frida today was really something that she really grasped and held on to when she was in Detroit, because she was staying around all of these very, very wealthy patrons, and she couldn't compete with all the pearls and the beautiful outfits. And so we really see her sort of coming into her own as a personality, fully formed. We also see, through the tragedy of the miscarriage that she suffered, we see her confronting pain and death in a way that she hadn't really before, though she'd been in pain since she was a young girl because of a hideous accident that she was in.
Yes, and so she was at Henry Ford Hospital, the one that everyone sees as we go along the Lodge Freeway. And from that agony at Ford Hospital, tell us about what that did to really to break new ground as an artist.
She brought with her, as you can actually see in the murals with Rivera, this kind of ability to address death and darker sides of things. And you see that in the Henry Ford painting, which is done with an almost naive technique. On the one hand, it's realistic. On the other hand, it has a kind of a folk art quality to it. And she combined with a realistic picture of herself lying in bed with the various components of her experience, her shattered pelvis from the accident, the fetus, those kinds of things. You know, really pretty tough stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And she went on to look at this aspect for the rest of her career. It really started here.
What works or artifacts are you most proud of securing for this exhibit?
Getting paintings by Frida has become difficult because she is so much in demand. There is almost never not a Frida exhibition somewhere. And in fact, the timing of our exhibition was affected by the fact that some crucial loans that we had to have, such as Henry Ford Hospital, had been committed to other exhibitions. So getting the Fridas, but then of course we have here all the time, we can't show them all the time, the magnificent drawings known as cartoons, life-size drawings that Rivera did in the actual process of making the murals, and they haven't been on view since 1984.
How do you think Detroit impacted these two artists?
For Rivera, he regarded this as his finest mural cycle, and just about every Rivera expert I've spoken to agrees with that sentiment. And he was lionized, he loved traveling, he loved the high life. But as I said earlier, for Frida, it was a very, very different experience, much more difficult and much more formative than her already established husband.
And as you've been here in Detroit and come to know Detroit, what do you believe their legacy was to Detroit?
I don't think you can attach a legacy to Frida here, much as we might like to. But certainly with Rivera, we had what was an extraordinary depiction of what it was that made Detroit great, the auto industry and all the people involved in working in those, especially the working man depicted on the walls of the most important cultural institution practically in the city of Detroit. I've been here for 15 years. It really had an elegiac quality to it. It looked, this was Detroit in the past. And you sort of looked at it and thought, isn't it too bad that everything seems to have gone so wrong? But now, with the stirrings of a real revival and what looks like a genuine long-term economic recovery of this region, it actually gives a sense of hope that it may not be purely building cars, although I personally think it probably will be, but it shows that this is the technical ingenuity, this engineering that made Detroit great, and that capacity, even with everything that's happened, is still here. And so I think the painting has become more celebratory again.
Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo in Detroit. It'll run March 15th through July 12th at the DIA. You can get more information and buy pre-sale tickets at DIA.org. Graham Beal is Director, President, and CEO of the Detroit Institute of Arts. Graham, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Frida Kahlo is widely known for her self-portraits depicting death and dark subjects, but she also had a love for life, and she loved to cook. With that, three Detroit-area chefs are paying tribute to the renowned Mexican artist, and they're guided by a book called Frida's Fiestas, Recipes and Reminiscences of Life with Frida Kahlo. The book was written by Guadalupe Rivera, who's the daughter of Diego Rivera. Stateside's Mercedes Mejia visited the restaurant El Barzon in Detroit and brings us this audio postcard.
My name is Norberto Garita. I'm the owner from El Barzon restaurant. We have a small Frida Kahlo menu, which is right here. So we have the mole negro oaxaqueño, we have the poblano, we have the red snapper a la veracruzana, chile relleno with picadillo, chile nogada, tampiqueña, and la barbacoa de chivo.
Garita shows me how he puts together the chile relleno picadillo, a green poblano pepper stuffed with shredded chicken and vegetables, sliced almonds served with a tomato sauce.
And then we put some carrot, col,
cabbage.
And then will be the chicken. Well, this one I make from the book, from Frida Kahlo's book. So we stuff the poblano pepper, and then with the
deep fry it,
and ready to go.
Garita calls his menu "Dining Like Diego and Frida." The first dish on the list, mole oaxaqueño.
Tell me about the mole oaxaqueño. What's in it?
Oaxaqueño has the chocolate, cinnamon, peanuts, oregano, cloves, sesame seeds too. We put it too as well. Yes.
22.
I will say about 22 ingredients. 22 ingredients. I mean, you will, when you bite, you will feel, I mean, different flavors of because the ingredients. Yes.
Garita serves the mole sauce over a turkey leg sprinkled with sesame seeds and a side of beans and rice.
To me, in Mexico, like say, it's a classic to have a mole with turkey. That's the original one.
Garita came to the U.S. when he was 16.
And I'm original from a small town they call it Platanar Tecomatlán, Puebla.
He cooked with Italian chefs in New York City for 10 years before relocating to Detroit. Here in Michigan, he worked at a high-end Italian restaurant for 8 years.
So we have Italian food as well as Mexican. So we do both. Yeah. Yeah.
Finally, Garita cooks up the red snapper, Veracruz style.
So when we say Veracruzana, what do we mean?
The vegetables. Green, yellow, and red pepper.
A fillet of red snapper sautéed with julienne onions, tomatoes, chilies, capers, olives, and oregano. The secret ingredient, a splash of white wine.
Wow, it smells delicious.
Yeah.
What's your favorite thing about cooking?
I mean, my favorite thing is, I mean, to be in the kitchen, you know, try to do different recipes. Makes me happy when people feel happy, and when they come, they try the food, they say, wow, it's a good food. And that makes me happy, you know. You serve the plate, we're ready to go.
And if you want to get a seat this weekend at the restaurant El Barzon in Detroit, you might have a hard time. Garita says the restaurant is completely booked this Saturday, but he says the special Dining Like Diego and Frida menu will continue into the summer. For Stateside, I'm Mercedes Mejia.
The Mackinac Bridge is the longest suspension bridge in the Western Hemisphere, fifth longest in the world. You look up, way, way up at those two towers, and you find yourself wondering, what's it like way up there? Well, Richard DeMara has the answer because he helped to build the Big Mac Bridge. Richard DeMara, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Very good to have you with us. So there you are, a member of Ironworkers Local 25. And when did you first hear about this bridge project? How did they describe it to you?
Well, I've heard about it before, 1956. I was living up in Sheboygan and working for Argus Cameras. I don't know if you ever heard of me from Ann Arbor.
We are in the Argus building.
No kidding. We made all the camera cases for the Argus Cameras up in Sheboygan.
So you hear about this bridge project?
Well, I heard about the bridge project, and I've been with Argus for 7-8 years, and I wasn't going anyplace with them. So I told them, I said, I'm going to try ironwork and try that Mackinac Bridge. So they said, you'll be back. And I said, don't plan on it. And I never turned back. I never went back. So.
And you worked for the American Bridge Company, and yes, you did wind up working up there at the highest point of the bridge. What were you doing on the bridge, Richard?
Well, when we were doing the cable work up there, we spun the cable. When they say spin the cable, they're not really making it go around, around, around. Every strand is laid out individually. There's 41,000 miles of it up there, and they're all in different bundles. And when the cable spinner went by, we'd have to sort those wires, make sure they all got in their particular spot because they were all went to one anchor bar way back in the anchor pairs.
Very important work.
We couldn't have the wires getting crossed because you'd never be able to bring up the tension on the cables and have them in the right place. So this is one thing we had to watch all the time. And I used to make my rounds between up in the top of Church 19 and going down towards the center span, checking those wires all the time. So we did that 6-7 days a week, 10 hours a day.
Boy, that's busy. How high up were you when you were at the highest point?
552 feet. It couldn't get any higher.
Do you remember your first time up there?
It was very exhilarating. We were just working off catwalk, and it was 10 feet wide, suspended by 5 cables. We had that all the way across the straits, all the way from one anchor pier to the next. November of 1956, we got all the wires spun, 24 and a half inches. We had the castings put on, and I say these castings. If you go across the bridge, you see the wires coming down from the top up there, the main cable that holds the roadway up.
Yeah.
Well, those 2 1/4 inch cables that we used to support the catwalk are the same 2 1/4 inch cables that we took out of there in 1956. In the fall, after we had the main wire all spun, we took those out and we sent them back to, I think, Ambridge, Pennsylvania, or someplace where they cut them up to length, put sockets on the end. We got them back in 57, in which we put them over the top of the castings up on top of the up in the cable, where they just hung down below, and then that's when we started bringing up the roadway sections.
And there it was, suspended. You know, I've got to wonder, when you were over 500 feet, as you say, it didn't get any higher. First of all, talk about the view, but also I've got to wonder what the wind was like up there.
Terrible. The wind blew every day, and the wind typically blows from west to east in Michigan, and we were right there, right in the middle of the Straits of Mackinac. When that wind blew, there wasn't anything to stop it. The only thing that stopped it was that lighthouse up at that little town about 75 miles from there. That's the only thing that broke up that wind, but when the wind was blowing, we knew it because it was in the middle of June. When we were on a night shift, we had all the clothes on we could stand, you know, because it was cold.
That is something. On a sunny day, can you give us a sense of what that view was like, even as you were dealing with the wind?
Oh, well, you know, the cable spinner just would go by about once every 20 minutes. And once it went by, you had a job to do to take care of those wires that you were spinning. And when it went by, it didn't come back for about 20 minutes. And I had plenty of time. I took a lot of pictures. You could see for, well, infinity just about either way. You could see to the horizon. You could either look one way and be looking all the way up Lake Michigan and look the other way and you're looking up Lake Huron.
Now, I know, Richard, there were workers who were killed during construction of the Mackinac Bridge.
Yes, we had 5 killed.
What happened? Do you remember those? Were you there that day?
I got there just after. That's when the 2 ironworkers came down from the top of the tower up there when they were placing more of our catwalk. And these catwalk sections came up in bundles of about 100 foot. And then we attached them to the 2 1/4 inch cables. And then they slid down and they got down to 100 foot. You had another 100 foot. And, well, back at that time, they had a hold back to hold it so it wouldn't go too fast or move too fast down. And the hold backs were out of 1-inch rope. Well, they thought that was going to hold it, but it didn't hold it. That rope broke. And,
boy,
and when it went down, 2 of the guys came right off at the top, went right straight down. And 2 of the guys were hung up in the cables, sliding down the cables of the 2 1/4 inch cables. One guy's name was Bobby Anderson. The other guy was named Louis Stedman. Stedman was a big Indian from down in Oklahoma, and he was quite a man.
Hmm. When that happened, Richard, did you find yourself thinking, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't be doing this?
I don't know if I thought that. Maybe I did at the time, but that's when I started my iron worker career for Local 25, and I worked 35 years after that. All kinds of jobs, anything from powerhouses to waste treatment plants, about every building that General Motors put up in Pontiac or Detroit or Lansing, I worked most all of them.
It has to feel pretty good inside to know that you were a part of something that is just such a significant part of what Michigan is.
Yes. I'm proud to say that I worked on the biggest job that ever hit the state of Michigan, and that was the Mackinac Bridge. So,
Richard DiMara will talk about his experiences building the Mackinac Bridge this Saturday, March 14th at 2 p.m. The program will be at the American Legion Post 18. That's at 700 Adams Street in downtown Bay City. And yes, the public is welcome. Richard DiMara, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, how Facebook makes us unhappy. And then, should Andrew Jackson get the boot from the $20 bill? That story in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. How often do you go on Facebook? And how do you feel after you do? A new study from the University of Michigan offers some insights for us. As much as we seem to love checking our Facebook feeds, the result might not be what you'd expect. Ethan Cross is an associate professor of psychology, and he's with the Institute for Social Research at U of M. His findings were recently published in the Journal of Experimental Psychology. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
And Michigan Radio social media producer Kimberly Springer is back with us. Hey, Kim.
Hi, Cindy.
Ethan, this is not the first time that you have looked into the effect that Facebook has had on its users. So let's set the stage for your latest study by having you take us back to your 2013 research. And you did establish using Facebook doesn't necessarily make us happier.
That's right. What we did in that study was really our first attempt to see how does interacting with this really pervasive technology impact the way people feel from one moment to the next. What we did there in brief was we use this technology called experience sampling, which sounds really fancy but ends up being pretty simple. We text message people 5 times a day for 2 weeks on their smartphones. And each time we text message them, we ask them a series of very simple questions like, how do you feel right now? How much have you used Facebook since the last time we text messaged you? And so forth and so on. And what we found in that study, which was really interesting, was the more people used Facebook in between two text messages, the more their moods declined from one moment to the next. And that relationship held over a 2-week period. And it was really interesting. And the big question, of course, that it raised was, well, what about Facebook leads to these declines in emotions? And that was really the motivation for doing this second study, which we just published.
So what did you build the study around? How did you construct it? And really, what did you find?
We went into it with the idea that, inspired from lots of other research, is that there are two principal ways that people use this technology, and they're called passive and active forms of Facebook usage. The simple way to think about those different types of usage are passive Facebook usage is about consuming information, so scrolling down, looking at one's newsfeed, looking at other people's posts. Active Facebook use is about producing information on the website or the technology. So it's chatting, posting about how you're doing and so forth. And what we wanted to see was, is it the case that one type of usage, passive for example, maybe that's what's really harmful, because what you're doing if you're passively scrolling is you're continually seeing how good everyone else's life is, because people tend to post positive information on the website.
We all know we very carefully curate our online presence, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. I mean, you got it with that curating comment. We put a great deal of effort into how we portray ourselves on this technology. And the idea is, if you're constantly exposing yourself to, oh my goodness, look at how nice Sally and Joe's life is, 50, 60 years of social psychological research, classic research, would suggest that that has a very clear effect on how people are going to feel. It's going to lead you to feel bad. So we wanted to see whether that was the case. And the other thing we, of course, wanted to do is look to see whether being active on this site, communicating with others, exchanging information, does that have any benefit, as some research suggests that it might? We did two studies to look at those different questions. Before I jump into the findings, we did the study two different ways. First, we did a laboratory experiment in which we told people to either use it passively or actively. The reason I'm bringing that up is because laboratory experiments are the only way that you can actually draw causal inferences about this variable leads to a causal effect on another variable.
So you want the science to be good.
We want the science to be good. And then we, of course, did a second study in which we tried to see how these different processes unfold in life over time. What we found across the two studies was a remarkably similar pattern of results. The more you use Facebook passively, the worse you subsequently feel. Using Facebook actively, on the other hand, has no implications for how people feel from one moment to the next. It's totally benign in terms of its implications for people's mood.
Doesn't necessarily make you feel upbeat and happy. It just is.
It just is. Does not influence the way you feel. What's also really interesting is guess whether people use Facebook actively or passively.
That's what I'm wondering. Tell me.
They are significantly more likely to be using Facebook passively than actively. So most of the time that people are using this site, they're using it in what our research suggests could be a harmful way for people's moods.
That's interesting. Kimberly, you're our social media producer here, and your job is to get people to interact with the content. Does that surprise you to hear that more people tend to use it passively?
It does, actually, but maybe that's just because of the volume of comments that we have on our Facebook page, which is unusual for public radio sites. We have a lot of commenters, a lot of regulars who come to the page.
And we've certainly seen here on Stateside, we have gotten much more traction and visibility when we post stories on Facebook and people can get involved. So perhaps our listeners are more of a rarefied group. But I'm wondering, we all have seen it. I have done it. You get a few extra minutes with nothing going on. Out comes a smartphone. On I go to Facebook. And I know I'm not alone. Why are we, Kimberly, so drawn to something that apparently is making us not feel good?
I think, was it Louis C.K., the comedian who had a bit of a tirade on one of the late night talk shows about how we just can't be bored anymore. We just have no tolerance for being bored anymore. And so it's very easy to pick up your phone and just start browsing through something that, you know, they call it a stream online. Mm-hmm. So just to let that stream kind of wash over you. So that's why I find this research really interesting, too.
And I think this question that you're raising is a really interesting one that we don't have the answer to yet. We ask our participants, why do you use Facebook? And there are lots of different motivations. Some people want to kill time. Some people want to stay in touch with others. Some people want to see what's going on. We know from other areas of research, though, that people have a really difficult time just being alone with their thoughts. A study that got a lot of attention showing that if you put people in a room and just have them sit for 5 or 10 minutes, they feel incredibly uncomfortable. Think about sitting at a restaurant waiting for your date to arrive. Out comes a smartphone. Now, I want to be very clear. I do not think that smartphones or online social networks are inherently bad for you. The challenge in all of this and what makes us so exciting for us as researchers is that we're seeing a tremendous shift in the way human beings interact, right? We've been interacting with other people for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And what we're trying to do in our research is figure out what are the adaptive versus maladaptive, helpful or harmful ways of interacting with this technology? The technology is here to stay, and for good reason. It can do lots of fantastic things. What we see is that the natural way that people interact with it, passively, tends to be harmful. But knowing that in and of itself is an important, I think, clue for cueing people how to harness this technology in more adaptive ways to improve their lives if they want to.
I have seen the phrase social snacking as we are checking out that network of friends and their posts and their photos. Is social snacking a good thing or no?
Well, if we were to extrapolate from our study, the answer is it depends on how you do it.
How you're snacking.
How you're snacking. Are you pinging your buddy to say, hey, what are you doing right now?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That shouldn't undermine the way you feel according to our results. But if you're tracking their vacation in Bora Bora and thinking, oh my goodness, that looks so great, and I'm stuck here in negative 20 degrees in Ann Arbor,
yeah,
might not be so good.
Now, Kimberly, your job is to understand what makes something shareable and what kind of enlivens things and gets people switching from passive to active. What do you see?
It seems like the things that get people to share that make them feel good are history or nostalgia. So they can tap into their own memories about it and talk about when they were there or their parents were
TBTs,
there.
TBTs, those Throwback Thursdays, are huge on Facebook.
Exactly.
Drag out the picture of myself in my, you know, toddler dress. And people seem to love that.
And there is data showing that if you ask a person to just review their own pictures and profile, that can have mood-enhancing effects.
Mm.
What we assume based on our data, though, is that most of the time that people are on Facebook and using it passively, they're not looking at all of their previous photos. They're looking at other people's information. So you can get really fine grain in trying to figure out what are the different patterns of these interactions that have up or down regulatory effects on people.
What else besides history?
Well, I just got some ideas for our Facebook page. But besides history, also videos. This weekend we had a video of someone skating on Lake Michigan, and that just went viral for us because people were interested in the vantage point of this person doing something unusual.
So you got to push the button. And then when people are engaged, what we find from your research, Ethan, is yes, they are feeling not necessarily better, but they're not feeling bad.
Mm-hmm.
What's the next question?
How do clinically depressed individuals, for example, differ in how they use this technology compared to healthy individuals? And the hope in doing some of this work is to identify ways that we can actually harness this technology to actually improve people's conditions, right? So we've now figured out, well, here's a specific way of interacting with it that leads you to feel bad. How can we identify ways of boosting the way people feel, and particularly vulnerable individuals?
So as we've made very clear, this technology, Twitter and Facebook, and none of this is going anywhere. So we're not going to be at a point of saying, gee, shouldn't we close down our Facebook accounts and actually look each other in the face and actually talk, because
it's here to stay.
In the same way that interacting with people in daily life is here to stay and has been here since the dawn of people. It's really about identifying the dynamics and how does it all work? How do these interactions work online?
Fascinating stuff. Kimberly Springer, Michigan Radio social media producer, and Ethan Cross, U of M Institute for Social Research. Thank you both so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
A nonprofit campaign calling itself Women on 20s thinks it's way past time to boot Andrew Jackson off the $20 bill. They're pushing to get one of 15 women who've influenced American history to replace the president. University of Michigan alum Susan Adis Stone is a former editor of the Michigan Daily, and now she's executive director of Women on 20s. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you for having me.
Why the $20 bill and why now?
The $20 bill is a bill, as you said, that we use more frequently than most of the other denominations. There are 11 denominations. They all bear portraits of men that haven't changed since 1929, and we think that is very last century, money 1.0, you could say. And, you know, women have played a huge part in shaping who we are today as a nation. You know, 2015, we are a much more diverse and inclusive country, and we think that our money should reflect that. Women should be valued and honored in more than just a token way.
Now, you've probably heard people say this already. Well, hey, Susan B. Anthony and Sacagawea got on the dollar coin. Why give Jackson the heave-ho?
Those are really more tokens than anything else, those dollar coins that Susan B. Anthony and Sacagawea are on. They're not widely circulated. They are really used more in vending machines. The Susan B. Anthony coin long ago stopped being minted. The Sacagawea is in very low production, and there's now a John Adams coin that really has almost replaced it. Really, it's our paper bills that people look to for the symbolism.
And you've got some concerns about Andrew Jackson's track record, don't you?
Andrew Jackson, like most presidents, has a mixed legacy. It's just that the blot of what's known as the Trail of Tears, Indian Removal Act that relocated many thousands of Native Americans and in the process caused much death and suffering. And, you know, that is a blot that has come to almost define Andrew Jackson more than anything else. Given that and the fact that he also was quite a fierce opponent of the central bank, and he despised paper currency. He believed that only hard currency, gold and silver coin, was legitimate money. So I think he would be the first to say, get me off of this bill. But also, with 2020 coming up, that's the centennial of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. It seems fitting that the $20 bill would be a great place to celebrate the legacy of the women who made that happen.
And you're asking the public to go to your website, womenon20s.org, and choose three contenders from this list of 15 potential candidates. And then what happens?
We will take the top three vote getters and we will bring them back to the public in a second round of voting. Then we will take that top choice and bring that to the White House. And, you know, with anything over 100,000 votes, we are pretty much guaranteed at least a hearing at the White House. But we hope it's going to be more, because President Obama has already said publicly that he thinks putting women on currency is a very good idea. Even though the Secretary of the Treasury has the authority to make this happen, we want this to be something that, you know, the people can voice to the White House.
And looking at the candidates, and of course, we know according to law, it has to be someone who has passed away. You can't have a living person on U.S. currency. So there's certainly been a lot of notice in Southeast Michigan that Rosa Parks is one of the candidates for this $20 bill. And of course, she moved to Detroit in 1957 and then lived in Michigan until she died in 2005. Do you see her as a strong contender?
I do see her as a strong contender because she really is seen as the face of the civil rights movement. I mean, of course, Martin Luther King, you know, is seen as the driving force, but she is very much a symbol of that movement. So, yes, she's very well recognized. Unlike some of the candidates who are less well known, she is, you know, someone who has entered the consciousness of the public. People may not actually recognize her image as much, but they certainly know her name. And so, yes, I do think she's a very strong contender.
And you certainly have other leaders in civil rights, women leaders like Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman. But you have some interesting people. I was intrigued to see Clara Barton, whom I, because I'm a Civil War nut, I do remember she really brought medical care to those wounded soldiers during the Civil War. She was the angel of the battlefield.
Yes, she was, and she was the one who founded the American Red Cross. All of the people who made the top 15 made lasting impressions and lasting changes to the way we function as a society.
And who are some of the other names on your list?
We also have Rachel Carson, who many consider the driving force behind the environmental movement in this country. She wrote a number of very popular and very influential books about air quality and pesticides that really sparked a lot of change and the protections that we enjoy today. Margaret Sanger, who is one of the more controversial candidates because she was responsible for legalizing birth control in this country and giving women, you know, a choice in planning their families.
You have some women who made some big strides in Washington, Shirley Chisholm and Barbara Jordan, and, of course, First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt. It is a very, very interesting list, bringing women from many areas who all made a difference. I guess I'm wondering, ultimately, how confident are you, Susan, that this campaign will lead to a woman's face on that $20 bill?
I think that we have a strategy that will, you know, coming from the grassroots, having as many people weigh in as we will, given that President Obama is inclined to do something that elevates women to a place of honor.
Susan Addis-Stone is Executive Director of Women on 20s. You can check out the entire list of these influential women and vote for your top three choices by going to their website, womenon20s.org. No apostrophes, just womenon20s.org. Susan, it was great to talk with you, and we'll keep tracking this and find out who the finalist is and then see what happens from there. Appreciate your time, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
Today, Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, Annie Norris, Lindsay Scullin, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.